is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacy Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We love to tell ourselves that justice ends at the verdict. But in America, justice often just kind of changes platforms a little bit. Brian Koberger can't leave his cell, but his story sure can. And in Idaho, that's where there's no Son of Sam law. That story could make him money. Free speech is sacred, but freedom to profit from murder? That's not right. That's an oversight. Eric Faddis is joining us to discuss, former prosecutor and defense attorney. Eric, when you hear that convicted killer, Brian Koberger, could legally make money off of his story, off of his crimes, what's your first reaction as a prosecutor or just as a human being?
Yeah, Tony, I mean, when you go out and slaughter innocent people, you shouldn't be entitled to some kind of benefit for that, some kind of monetary windfall for those horrible misdeeds. And so that's my initial impression. I think that's how a lot of society sees it. You know, on the other hand, there are interests regarding free speech and that kind of thing. And so it's sort of a balance that the courts and legislators have to look into. And it looks like it wasn't adequately looked into, at least in Ohio.
And the thing is, with the Son of Sam laws, it's kind of a quilt of it across the United States. Every pattern, every square, a little bit different in terms of what it allows for and what it doesn't allow for. And some patches of that quilt are just blank. And that would be what Idaho is. There's nothing there. No thought put into it because there's never been legislation on the books for it. And where it is on the books, a lot of places has been watered down. It's been changed. It's been this. It's been that. Some have stronger ones, some have weaker ones. Idaho never passing one in general. I mean, walk us into what that means in plain terms. What's legally allowed and what shouldn't be in Idaho?
Yeah, you know, Tony, I mean, these laws have come about. The Son of Sam law came about in New York, where they had a mass killer, the Son of Sam. He wanted to profit off his crimes by writing a book, and they said, hey, no, you can't do that. You know, I'm not sure Idaho perhaps envisioned that they might have some mass killer who might want to do this there. Perhaps they should have, but they didn't. What it means, Tony, is that at least as the law stands right now, Koberger could write a book, he could write a tell-all, he could receive monies from that tell-all, and that could make his lifestyle better while in prison for the rest of his life, substantially better, potentially.
Can we talk about what that means? Sorry about that, Tony. Can we talk about what that would mean for his life in prison if he's got more money? How much of that would he even be able to use? Would it even be worth it to him?
Stacey, I think it would because, you know, there are a number of ways you can improve your situation while in prison. One is just through basic commissary. He would have the ability to kind of purchase the goods that he wanted, higher end food items. One thing that can do is that can be used as money in prison, and he can make trades. He can gain loyalty and power and influence potentially, and protection as well. On top of that, you know, he could send money to other inmates. I mean, just talking hypothetically, but possibly prison gangs to try to get protection therefrom, to try to get them to do things he wanted them to do. And so there is really a cascading effect of such an inmate receiving substantial funds, even though they are locked up.
So there's no limit on how much he can use per month, that kind of thing.
There may be institutional limits at different facilities. But that being said, if you're sitting on, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars or more, and you're going to be in there for the next 40 True. Plus years, that has a cumulative effect over time.
It's almost, I mean, I guess the way I would try to think about it would be almost like a video game. You're playing in the world of that prison, and there's certain limits as to what you can put into your container of goods of what you can add to it. And if you got, you know, enough points or whatever in the game, you can max that out. You can, True. You know, get everything you need, everything that you could possibly within the confines of the limit. So, you know, it's not like he's, you know, going to necessarily be buying a Rolls Royce and right. be going around the prison yard. But, you know, he could have, you know, whatever hot top, you know, top items there are in all of them, and use that as currency and use that as status and use that as comfort, I think, at the end of the day. I think that's the biggest thing that people are angry at, is the idea that he can still maintain some level of comfort behind bars. Let's speak to that a little bit, because there are, you know, there are limits, like you said, you know, in prison cells of what you can and can't have. I mean, what's been your experience when you've, you know, you've had clients or you've dealt with folks that have been behind bars? What has shocked you the most, you know, in your line of work, where what you see going on behind those bars in terms of creature comforts that maybe the outside world is not super aware of?
You know, within those prison walls, within jail walls, and any sort of correctional institution, you know, you'd be surprised how valuable like a honey bun is, or how, mm-hmm. you know, these folks, there's a scarcity of you know, sort of delightful food items, and you'd be surprised how far it can go and how much you can gain from having possession of these things, trading them for favors, for protection, for other comforts. And then you got to look to the outside. The walls of that correctional facility, there are transactions that are made all the time. There are agreements that are brokered within the facility such that, you know, a person who has funds might send some of those funds or direct them to be sent to an inmate's family outside, or an inmate's friends or gang members potentially, to pay their bonds, to pay for legal fees. There are all sorts of transactions that happen outside the prison walls as well that are contemplated by a prisoner who acquires substantial monies.
How is it that we have a state like this? Because it's not like Idaho is short on crime. I mean, Idaho has its fair share of crazy folks. I mean, people kind of go to that part of the country when they're not in the best of mindsets. Like, I'm going to go off here, be by myself, and then, well, shit ends up hitting the fan for many of them. Why do you think it is that that state just doesn't have any sort of law like that on the books? Is it ignorance? Is it politics? Is it fear of being called anti free speech? What's your conjecture on it, Eric?
You know, it's a bit puzzling, Tony, because we've had this issue arise decades and decades and decades ago. It came about with the Son of Sam issue, and that was in the 70s. You know, it's 2025 right now. You would expect that a legislature would say, hey, yeah, a criminal should not profit from the crimes that they did and get a ton of money from it. But perhaps there were other legislative priorities. Perhaps they didn't foresee that kind of thing happening in their state. You know, it's not Los Angeles, it's not New York, that kind of thing. But that doesn't excuse this kind of omission. It seems like it should be in place everywhere, and it's not. And now we have a criminal who might make a shit ton of money off of slaughtering these four innocent college students.
Well, it's a weird thing, because the argument, well, it's hampering free speech. I don't know that I agree with that, because if you were to have, and the states that do have these sort of things in place, it doesn't prevent someone from sharing their story. I mean, and the purpose of that would not be to prevent him, if he wants to go do his tell-all, do your tell-all. You just can't make money on it, basically, is what it would state. But it also, here's, I guess, how it could hamper it, but then you have to go back to motivation of somebody trying to profit off of the murders by getting information directly from the killer. Because if you have a law like that in place, great, the killer can profit off of it. But you know who else can profit off of it? The people who are spending the time making it. So the creator, if you will, that wants to go in and do the tell-all story with Brian Koberger also couldn't take that information, couldn't take whatever they gleaned off of him, and then go and write the book and publish it, because and then profit from it, because that would have been directly from him, from what he has contractually agreed to give that creator. So that pretty much takes away the incentive, if you will, for any sort of creator, publisher, whatever, from wanting to go in and have that conversation, because it's not profitable. And at the end of the day, that's what drives all of it. People are going to want to make some money if they're going to put their time at it. So at the end, then
Nobody wants to tell the story because nobody's making money. But is that story worth being told at some point in time? I guess that is the conundrum and where the free speech argument comes in. What's your thoughts on that kind of vicious circle that creates?
Yeah, Tony, I hear you. And MNT7949, thanks for the shout out. Glad you're here. So when it comes to free speech stuff, I'm aligned with you that, hey, these people should be able to express themselves in terms of making statements about this matter of public concern, this crime that they committed. But that's where the line should be drawn is the making money piece. You know, when you think about things like other expressive activity under the First Amendment, you know, you can make provocative, risque art, but you can't make child exploitative material and say, oh, well, you know, I was just it's just expressive. I'm just expressing my free speech. The law does draw lines there. Free speech is not absolute. And I think what the line that is being established, hopefully, is criminal profiteering. So, yeah, you can talk about your crimes, but you can't cash in on them after the fact. But there are, like you said, sort of workarounds where different producers and media teams can, in a roundabout way, try and profit from that. And, you know, who's to say that those profits would not go to Koberger's family, would not somehow through a convoluted chain of transactions get back to him. There are a lot of issues that abound when we talk about these productions of art regarding these crimes.
Stacey, do you have a question?
I do. I want to know, can the families get out ahead of this? Can they file some sort of preemptive injunction before things happen, or do they have to wait? Almost like, you know, we'll put up the stop sign after a bunch of people die at the intersection, kind of a concept.
The thing is, Stacey, they would have to have a law on which they could hang their hat, on which their motion or request to the court or whomever would be based. And when you have in Idaho a lack of such a law, you know, they can't just go and say, hey, this would be terribly unfair. You guys shouldn't allow this. They kind of need a legal mechanism by which they could bring that to some kind of arbiter like a court. And no such legal mechanism appears to exist in Idaho. So the family do have other roundabout civil remedies that they could try to sort of obstruct Koberger's ability to get money from this. But in terms of a direct legal path to say, hey, stop this guy, I don't think they got it.
Damn it.
I mean, how has this worked in other states when they are realizing, oh, shit, this guy could start making some money on this? Obviously, if there is legislation in place, it's there. But, you know, is this something where they can get out ahead of it in other ways in terms of getting something in place? And if they were to, say, get some sort of legislation in place that says you can't profit from this, would it be applicable to only cases going forward after that? Or would it be applicable retroactively towards Koberger?
So that would depend in part on the nature of the legislation, the provisions therein. Legislators can put in provisions for retroactive application, and there are sometimes some legal challenges to such a provision. But even if it was only prospective prohibition of saying, hey, Koberger, you can't like write a book and make a bunch of money from it, if they were able to get that law in place before the book was published, that would still probably prevent any criminal profiteering from some subsequent piece of literature, if you want to call it that. So it is possible if the legislator acted quickly that they could try to improve this issue, but they haven't.
Is there an argument here there where it would discourage not want to say exploiting the case, but studying the case? Because, I mean, it all comes down to how the case is being looked at. For example, Catherine Ramsland's book about BTK, that was a very clinical look at Dennis Rader. I don't know the monetary logistics of it all, but I don't believe he profited from it from any way, shape, or form. I'm going out on a limb and guessing she did, because, you know, she's a clinical psychologist, a forensic psychologist, and I'm not saying that's wrong that she did. She's doing this from a very clinical type place. She's not coming to it from a a creator, a podcaster, a whatever, some News Nation, whatever it may be. It's a very different way, shape, or form. Should there be, and I guess, is there, are there any provisions in the states that do have these sort of laws in place that recognize the difference between someone that's, you know, strictly for profit, we're creating entertainment, we're creating things for people to consume and making money off of it, versus I'm creating this, going to make some money off of it because my time is valuable, but I'm coming to it from a more clinical type standpoint.
You know, and that's exactly where the tension lies, Tony, because mm-hmm. on the flip side of this issue, we want public access to information. Mm-hmm. The entire world, including the victims' families, we're dying to know sort of Koberger's motivation behind this,
yes.
The way he went about it, the details of it, whether he had anyone helping him. Mm-hmm. That's important to know, you know, just from a epistemological standpoint, but also from a preventative standpoint. Hey, how can we stop this in the future? What red flags can we jump on mm-hmm. that were elucidated during this during a piece that explores how this came about and who this criminal was. That's certainly important. And I think really that the line that's trying to be drawn is that criminal profiteering line where they're saying, hey, you can investigate, you can do a social sciences exploration of what happened here, but Koberger can't be receiving funds directly from it. Mm-hmm. But then there's always the potential workaround of him indirectly yeah. receiving some kind of benefit.
There's always going to be loopholes and stuff. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Stacey.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I'm curious. I don't know a whole lot about our penal system, about what it's like to be incarcerated. Somebody like Koberger, where he just said, okay, I'm guilty. We're going to skip the trial. We're not going to see what I did. We're not going to see my motivation. Can they send somebody in to evaluate him and get these details? They've got some of them, obviously, but to actually release them as data for prevention, things like that, to maybe circumvent writing a book, that here is his case study. We went in, we figured out what was going on with him, and here are the facts.
Stacey, I'm not aware of any legal impediment to someone going in and trying to do that. Except that you have to have the declarant's cooperation. You have to have the criminal's
correct.
Cooperation. And so how do you get that? You know, is he going to do it out of the goodness of his heart?
But he likes the yeah. limelight, though. He likes the spotlight. He may like to be featured in some scientific article. So if you took it from that aspect, he might jump all over it.
All about the approach. How
correct.
You pitch it, basically. How you pitch it to him.
Completely true, because in part, as you know, Stacey, he was a PhD student. He at least
yes.
has some ostensible interest in the scientific studies. And so, yeah, perhaps you could persuade him to do it. But if he's like, I'll do it, I'll give you an interview for $5,000, that's right. going to be a non-starter.
And that's the thing. When there's, if you were to go into him and you were to pitch it as this is for science, this
right?
Is, it's like the Michael Scott check. I'm writing this out to science. It's maybe you could sway him, but if there's an option of, well, why would I give it to you when there's this other creator over here who's willing to give me all this and basically keep my canteen filled for life? Why would I give it to you when I could give it to them? At the end of the day, they don't care. The information is going to get out in some way, shape, or form. That's why it's important to have something in place. So there is less choice. If you want to tell your story, yeah. you can tell your story, but you're not going to only take the paying options here to do it. You've lost that ability when, you know, you were found guilty or you admitted guilt in this case. Why is it, do you think, Eric, that we don't have national laws on this? Why? I mean, is this something that needs to be state by state? Because we have obviously judicial systems that are based state by state. Obviously we have national charges too. We have federal charges or you have state charges. And then everybody's in on different types of charges. So would it be difficult to basically have a federal mandate that says, well, this is how this works, if they're in on a state charge like Koberger is?
I think it's a great question because I also don't see any legal impediment to having a national law about it. And in fact, there's probably some political will on both sides behind that. You know, not a lot of people are going to object and say, no, 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 I want this killer to make thousands of dollars. It seems like that would be a relatively easy thing to get the political will to support. And Ruth City makes a good point in the comments, too. She mentioned that Koberger didn't share his motive and he will use that for a cash grab later. That was my suspicion. Mm-hmm. When such provision was not included in the plea agreement, they could have said, hey, in order to get death penalty off the table, you got to tell us your motivation why you did this. They did not include that. And I was wondering if Koberger was keeping that close to the vest for a possible payout down the road.
Why do you think they did that from a legal standpoint? Why on earth do you think the DA, who I've called Santa Claus several times in this because he has the Santa Claus beard, why do you think they didn't put that in there? Their families wanted it. I think the public wanted it. I think humanity wanted it. Was that, I mean, it's quite an oversight to say it's just an oversight, but why on earth do you think that they did not make him talk? If you want to take this plea, great, but you're going to talk like they did with Rader, like they've done with others. With him, it does feel like he got off way too easy without having to say anything. I don't know. Was it just the lack of motivation on the part of the DA or the prosecutor? I don't know. What's your take on that?
You know, it's hard to say. I can only speculate, but I'm wondering, you know, that's not a terribly common provision to be in plea agreements where the defendant has to give his reasons for what he did and talk about his motivation. However, it's not unprecedented. Like you said, it's happened before. They can build that into the plea agreement. I don't see any constitutional issue with that at all. And, you know, if you want the death penalty off the table, why don't you come and at least tell these families, give them some peace of mind as to what happened and why you did this. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the prosecution was just sort of getting close to the trial is going to be a huge nationally publicized thing, a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. And I'm wondering if they went to Koberger and said, hey, we want this provision in there. And he said, you know, I'll plead guilty to the four murders, but I'm not doing that provision. And they said, well, this is the best outcome we're going to get aside from going to trial. So we'll take it.
Yeah. So they should have called his bluff on that. I mean, at the end of the day, I think will always, you know, I know it's bothered so many people, and I think is one of the biggest mistakes in the way that case was handled. The reality is with all this, even if there is a law that's in place, even if there is some motivation here, and hope to God there is, if there's any case that would drive some sort of legislation to be in place fairly quickly, I would think this might be the case for Idaho to get something on the books.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, even if that is on the books, it doesn't stop anyone from going, I'm going to go fill Koberger's canteen. And the reality is that is happening right as we speak. That's kind of what brought this conversation to light, is there's still a lot of pro-burgers out there. And I mean, there always has been these people. This goes back, you know, as long as someone's been incarcerated, there's been some whack jobs out there that want to get married to them and somehow think they're innocent and, you know, they exist. I mean, to me, it's like, see something, say something. Those are the unstable folks. Maybe we should lock up as well, because there's something wrong with you if this is what you're doing. But we don't live in that type of society. That would be the Tony land, which I don't think anybody wants to live in other than me. But the thing is, people can do that right now. There's nothing in place stopping that. Should there be something in place that stops the general public from having that ability to just on a whim go to the prison's website or however the hell they do it, and dropping money into the canteen of somebody that they feel sympathetic to? Or should that be limited to direct family or things of that nature? I'm not saying it has to be impossible for that to happen from the outside. I, you know, they are human beings. There should be some level of this, of, you know, where you could help someone that maybe be blood connected to you. But I don't know what that line is or where you would actually put that.
This is really a possibility, Tony. I didn't know this. That
you can do it right now. That's what brought this conversation.
But I get that. But like, you and I could just go put money in his canteen.
Yes, we could. Do it for anybody. You could propose marriage to him right now, Stacey.
That will never happen.
I'm not saying you would, but I'm saying you could.
Are you sure?
Todd, you shut your hole. Your word hole needs to
How much have you put in Luigi's canteen so far?
The guy works out. He's stacked. Okay,
that's back it up. Hit the button. Yes. Okay.
But we're no, gonna, I had no, no idea yeah. that the yeah. general, thank you, Todd.
Yep.
That yep. the general public for any inmate could do yeah. that. I knew that people were giving money to Koberger, but I thought maybe that was just people who were in his family, that kind of thing. I didn't realize that it was general public that could go and say, you know what, I've got an extra $40 this
yes.
month.
And unfortunately, that's what's happening right now with Brian Koberger.
And that's just sickening. How is that even possible? Again, like you said, Tony, these people are human. They do deserve basic things. But where are we drawing the line here, folks?
It's like the more infamous you are, the more you're going to get.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely something that can be done right now. You know, Luigi Mangione is getting a ton of love while incarcerated pending his charges. And it'd be really a sticky situation to try and have a law that says, hey, you know, Joe Smith, who lives in Idaho, you can do pretty much whatever you want with your money, but you can't give it to this guy. Mm-hmm. And Joe Smith might say, hey, what the heck? You know, I see this differently. I think that the guy is innocent or whatever that they yeah. might think. And people are entitled to have, you know, positions that yeah. are wrong and to take action on those positions. So I think the workability and the enforcement of such a law would be problematic. However, I think you could probably prohibit funding any sort of criminal profiteering, but then how do you distinguish, hey, no, I was just giving him money for the honey buns and not this, you know, to set up this future media yeah. piece he wants to do? That would be tough as well.
Well, I mean, and maybe that the policing of it is what it is. It is limited. There is only so much you can spend on your canteen on a weekly basis or day or whatever it is. Most prison systems do have that, where it's X amount. You can't like buy out the fucking canteen.
Right. You can't have like $100,000 sitting there.
And then become the canteen. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, because if you had that, then you know that you could do that. If you have endless funds, I'm gonna buy everything. And then you can jack up the price and then resell it from your cell, or you know, get shanked and have somebody steal it all from you. But I mean that's where the regulation does come into place, but then it does give them an endless supply of whatever they want, you know, within the means of that system. I don't know that there is a true mechanism that would truly stop this, because when you say, if you were to look at this case, Koberger, you go, yes, heartless, evil bastard, no food for you. But that's my opinion. That's pretty much, you know, I think society, healthy society as a whole's opinion. But how do you regulate it? How do you say, well, this guy is like this, but this guy who's also in here is like this. But if there's empathy over here for this person, maybe a lesser crime, how do you distinguish the two? You really can't, and say, well, because this person gets this, then you can't get this. It creates far more issues than it actually solves, I think, at the end of the day. And then we get lost in the minutia and the chaos. And maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's why Idaho hasn't done anything, because they're like, it's just more chaos. We're just going to limit you to like $40 a week and that's it. I don't know.
You know, if I may, there's one way that could help prevent Koberger from criminally profiteering from this. And it's sort of referenced in a comment from Shanna Edwards. So sorry for the loss of your niece, yeah. where she says the defendant was ordered to pay what he owed from his own funds in his commissary. And that is what could happen here. If the families sue Koberger for wrongful death and prevail, then they would have a judgment against him. And then any funds going to him could be subject to garnishment or complete depletion based yeah. on this outstanding amount that he owes. So even though you can't do it in a direct or it'd be hard to do it in a direct legislative way, you can do it in this roundabout civil remedy way. And I imagine the victim's families are thinking of doing just that.
Well, I mean, and that's how it that's how it works right now with the judgments. And that's why Koberger is making that argument in court of, well, these families are made whole by GoFundMe, so I shouldn't have to pay anything in judgment. Right. Like, no, you should, because the way it's currently structured is 20% of whatever is in that account that you have is going directly back to the families to pay that restitution. Lori Vallow-Daybell trying to make the same argument, going, I'm in prison. I don't have any money. Well, guess what? Any money that does go into that account, 20% has to go back. And that's just how it's structured. One could argue, well, maybe it should be 100%, maybe it should be 80%, maybe it should be whatever. I feel like it should be a hell of a lot higher than 20%. But essentially, it's like wage garnishment at that point. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it is. But when you're behind bars for something like this, you know, naturally we want to see the person burn. And we want to have very, very little leeway, very little room for comforts. But again, that is how our system works. And that is why they are arguing, why am I paying these sort of, why should I have to pay? You're getting paid this or that. Because it's on you. Because someone paying your fees doesn't, you know, wipe your responsibility off of for it. But with that being said, again, there is this something that because every state, every system is so different, do we really need some sort of just national guideline, some sort of national law that says, here's how it works in this country? Would that fix a lot of these state-to-state issues?
I think totally. And when we're talking about, you know, what laws ought to be federal, what laws ought to be state by state, you know, if it's a matter of a local concern, you know, for example, when it comes to certain agricultural practices or certain mining practices, natural resource practices, that kind of thing, that's kind of a state-to-state thing. So, you know, some localities might say, hey, this industry helps our state and we want this kind of mining, whereas a second locale might say, hey, we don't want that, and that's a state-by-state issue. But here, there's no such matter of local concern that would dictate that such a prohibition should be state-by-state. It seems like a criminal profiteering is wrong, you know, any which way you look at it, mm-hmm. no matter what state you're in, which would militate in favor of some sort of federal legislation.
Damn it.
So it's a messy one. It's because it's easy to go down the road of emotion on this, but then you got to look at the bigger picture. How would this, you know, you legislate, you can't just legislate for one inmate. And right. that's the reality of it. So does, you know, is it good for the greater good, or is this just legislating out of vindictiveness towards one person? Because that's never going to be an effective route of doing anything.
I also wonder how much Koberger, whether there's money involved or not, would just want to do this to get back at the families and feel some sort of control over the way this thing all laid out.
That's a great point.
I think that's what it's all about at the end. It's all about control. That's the one thing that feeds him. And this is the one little place he still has ability to have some control in, unless there is some action taken. So if anybody is angry about this right now and you are in Idaho, you got to call your legislators. Yeah. You got to let them know you want something to change, because they're not going to listen to people from outside of Idaho, number one. If you're in Idaho and you think this is crazy, then do something about it. Do something about it. Be on offense. Let's not be reactionary on this. Let's try and do something about it. You're not going to solve everything. In a roadblock is a roadblock. A speed bump is a speed bump. It's better than nothing. And it feels like there should be something there, because right now it's pretty much free game for Brian Koberger if he wants to make some money on this, which is pretty sick. But it is reality, and it's good with dealing with reality on reality's terms.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.